Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Season 3 of Queer I Am, the podcast, live and unscripted. I am so excited to share this with you. The podcast has been recorded over 8 weeks in front of a live audience at Arco Baleno, an inclusive queer space in the heart of Kemp Town, Brighton. I am so proud to be partnering with Arco Baleno and cannot thank Luciana, Nick and the whole team there enough for their support and generosity in the making of this season of the podcast. If you haven't been there before, please check it out. Not only do they have an incredible Maltese menu for you to explore, but they also have a range of cocktails, drinks, and a regular schedule of entertainment for you to enjoy. The podcast is also being supported by their production company, Across Rainbows Productions, and film for YouTube. So if you didn't get to come to one of the live shows, you can find these videos at your leisure on the Across Rainbows YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe, give the videos a like, and leave any comments you may have. We also had several authors participate in the shows, and Kemp Town Bookshop were on hand to sell signed books by the authors. You can check out this beautiful bookshop in the heart of Brighton, but make sure you take your credit card because you will not leave empty-handed. The shows feature a panel of guests where we'll be talking all things queer, and an audience Q&A too, an opportunity for everyone to get involved in the conversation. In this episode, we'll be discussing queer mental health. The show features author Michael Hendrick, LGBTQ+ domestic abuse worker and outreach lead at Across Rainbows charity, Melanie Blackwell, founder and director of the Across Rainbows charity, Luciana Cousins, and performer Alex Fincher. I hope you enjoy the show. So whatever you're up to, this is your time to settle down, relax, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to Queer I Am. So welcome, everyone, to Queer I Am, the podcast, live and unscripted, episode 5. Can't believe it's episode 5 already. Only a few more to go. It's going very, very quickly. But this one, we're talking about mental health, so queer mental health. So thank you all for coming. It's a very intimate crowd, but that's actually really lovely. So I'm going to introduce my guests for this amazing conversation. So first of all, and again, best outfit of the evening. I'm sorry, folks, but... You look.
Stop it, you're embarrassing me. Stop it.
You look incredible. So we have the amazing podcaster and drag performer, Alex Fincher. Big round of applause.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, absolute pleasure. We have the owner of Arco Baleno and the founder of Across Rainbows Charity, which focuses on redefining queer identity. And identity. Oh my God, I've had two wines already. Identity. Luciana Cousins.
Hello.
We have domestic abuse support worker and outreach lead for Across Rainbows, Melanie Blackwell, who is also an amazing painter. So check out her work because it's incredible. The picture, you did the David Bowie picture, right, that I published today? Yeah, so check out Melanie's work. It's amazing. And we have the amazing author who was responsible for this incredible book, which I read last year, and I'm really happy that you'll be reading something from it today. Michael Hendrick, the author of Difference is Born on the Lips. So a big round of applause, please. A few weeks ago, I forgot to introduce the guests, so we're already doing all right, which is good. So I always ask this on every episode, and I'm not going to shy away from this today. So if you all had a song to reflect your mood right now in this moment, small icebreaker, what would your song be? And we've been talking about music outside quite a lot, haven't we? So I'm guessing what some of the answers might be, but I'm going to start with Alex. So what would your song of the moment be?
Currently, I'm a singer-songwriter, and I like to think of all of moments in my life as like eras. And right now I think I'm in my villain era. So I would say Crazy by Doechii, if anyone knows that song, or go Google it afterwards. It's very chaotic. And
can you give us a couple of lines?
I don't think I'm allowed to say half of the words in that song.
I mean, you can say what you want on the podcast.
I'll let the audience go find it. Yeah, because I don't think I'm quite dressed for that song right now.
Luciana?
I could tell you, yeah, but for about 10 days, I've had the same song on a loop in my head.
Okay.
Padam, padam. It's so annoying.
But it's number one, isn't it? She's done incredibly well.
Because
with it.
It doesn't get out of your head.
Yeah, yeah, we were listening to it in the park.
I'm not even sure I like it.
No.
It's just constantly. Is that padam,
padam? It's all in the hook. She does very well with that, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so yeah. A bit of Kylie, nice.
Yeah, which I don't even like kind of, but anyway.
Melanie? Or is it Melanie, Mel? What do you prefer?
I don't really mind.
You don't mind? No. Okay. So what would your song be?
So I've been listening to a lot of Melissa Etheridge. Like, okay. It's normal, but my favourite song is Nowhere to Go.
Nowhere to Go. Okay.
Yeah, and I actually had that on blast earlier while I was cycling, so it was probably that one.
Okay, cool. Michael?
I think, I don't know if this is an overshare, but I was singing her in the shower this morning. Probably Prima Donna by Marina and the Diamonds.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lovely. Yeah. Okay. Amazing. I've just had Tina in my head all weekend. R.I.P. Tina meant very much to me. So I didn't actually know her, but, you know, so I've literally listened to Tina on loop for the last kind of 5 days. She did a very good version of the Beatles' Help. I don't know if everyone's ever heard that before. She did like a ballad version. Very good. Very emotional. So that's been on my kind of my playlist. But nice. Always a good icebreaker to talk about music, I think. So, but we are talking about something very serious today. So we're here talking about mental health. And I guess it's a really complicated subject by nature. But I think it's a really important one. So I'd like to ask all of you how important it is for you all to discuss mental health generally, and how important you think it is for us to be keeping the conversation going generally, not just on this podcast, but, you know, in society. Start with you, Alex.
Well, personally for me, I've kind of always grown up with quite an open dialogue about mental health. Like, my mum is, that's just how my mum raised me and my sister. And all three of us came from like very traumatic backgrounds. So yeah, it's always been like an open dialogue. I think as an adult now, I find myself trying to be an open book a bit more, not like running around in the street being like, you know, shouting my emotions, like I'm tired, like, or whatever. But
you can do that.
I just, yeah. And but I, especially with my friends and stuff, I'm trying to be. Sometimes I can find myself retreating and becoming a bit of a recluse. I'm trying not to do that now as an adult. That was definitely me in my early 20s and teenage years. Oh God, I've just like exposed that I'm not an only 20-year-old. Forget what you heard. Forget what you heard.
Don't worry, I'm probably still older than you, so it's fine.
I always do say black don't crack, but it do creak. It do creak. I forgot what your second part of the question was. I'm so sorry.
Just how important it is. And I think you've kind of answered it, really.
It's, yeah, it's important, very important.
To keep that going. Absolutely. What about you, Luciano?
I think it's very important. I think over the last maybe 2 decades, it's become more mainstream. Mm-hmm. So people are not shamed about having mental health issues. But still, there is a stigma attached.
Yeah.
We sort of okay with, you know, depression. We're okay with this, but there's certain ones that, you know, they're still not spoken about. They're still not out in the open.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's also very difficult if you're going through something to actually open up to someone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, safe spaces then become really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mel?
So similar to Alex, I grew up with an acknowledgement of mental health, but in a way that we didn't speak about it. So okay. My mum had lots of issues, so I was really aware of lots of detrimental sides of mental health, but wasn't really given the tools to address it. So now I think it's really important that I have an awareness and I try and understand, because I've always been understanding, but I just didn't have the tools to access
to deal with it,
the support, really.
Yeah.
And now a lot of the stuff that I deal with is part of helping people with that, because having the kind of the bravery to tell someone that you're having issues with mental health can be really difficult. So, and sometimes for my own mental health, I take days out where I just have to sit in a quiet room. And I know sometimes that that's happening now, so I don't feel too bad about it. Like, I'll just take a day off and I'll sit in a room and just watch like shit TV, because that's what I need for to calm whatever's going on in here. So. Yeah,
we all have those moments. And do you think, and we'll come on to your work in a bit, but do you think that your experiences have influenced your want to do the job that you do now? Was it always an interest for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't always know that this is where I was going, but I've always been like a bit of an empath and understanding, but I just didn't know that that's how I could push that feeling of what I had with me. Was I've done a lot of hospitality work and decorating and whatever. Like, I've worked with people, mm-hmm. but I've never helped people until the last few years. And now this feels like, oh, that feels like the right thing I should be doing.
Amazing. That's incredible. What about you, Michael?
I think different that I grew up working class and Catholic, and it was a very kind of stoic, very, you get on with things, keep your head up, don't get upset, don't be emotional. Kind of mental health wasn't a thing until probably my mid to late 20s. And it was very much just don't be weak. If you're feeling depressed or anxious, it was a sign of weakness. And I think until fairly recently, it was like I got to the point where I had to start acknowledging my mental health and understanding it and working through what makes my mental health more positive and, you know, how I can help myself. I think, you know, it's vital that we talk about mental health. Especially within the queer community, you know, with the trauma that we live through, the microaggressions, the kind of societal inequalities, mental health is, you know, imperative that we talk about, that we open it up. And I feel like so many of us are just trying to get through things and we don't stop to acknowledge it and to talk about it and open up about it. So I think, you know, we're now getting that to that point where, as Luciana was saying, that for so long it hasn't really been a societal wide conversation. But I think specifically within the queer community, it's something that, you know, we have to talk about it. We have to, you know, discuss with each other what we're going through. And sometimes it is hard to reach out to each other and say, I need help. But, you know, we need to get over that fear of feeling like a burden, or, you know, people won't understand, and we need to kind of,
I think you have to surround yourself with people that really can listen and can help. I remember having a really poor episode in my mid-20s and being told, you just cope, you get on with things, you don't take time from work, you put on a brave face, and I remember just thinking, why do we do that? And yet that was instilled within me. It was like, that's something I had to do. And it was, as you say, a weakness. It was seen as something that was something to be ashamed of. And I think that the great thing is now we are more open about it. I think if you go back 20, 30 years, someone that had a diagnosed mental health condition, the words and the terminology that was used for that were just so awful. And so you believe, you grew up believing that actually to have anything less than positive or great mental health, especially as queer people, we have so much other stuff kind of going on, but you, it's almost like a failure. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
And it's only when you get to a point when you say, actually, no, this is just what it is and I need to deal with this, it almost gives you that space to be able to say, okay, this is the way to kind of move forward. But I think that's probably really common. I mean, we don't normally go to audience Q&A now right now, but did everyone kind of hear those messages when you were growing up about mental health? Was it kind of cope and get on with things and be brave? And
yeah. Or even just not discussed about. Like, I remember at school, I don't think it was ever mentioned. I think maybe depression was mentioned once, but like anything about mental health, I don't remember being discussed at all at school. And that's such a vital time when you learn about, you know, your health in all of its assets. But mental health was never mentioned at school at all.
Absolutely. I've got some stats here, which I wrote down earlier. I've done a bit of research. I had to write these on a separate piece of paper because there's quite a lot. But I thought it'd be interesting to share this. So 2021, and you've probably heard some of these as well doing the work that you do, but Mental Health Foundation published the following about queer mental health. So depression, self-harm, alcohol, drug abuse, and suicidal thoughts can affect anyone, but they are more common with LGBTQIA plus people. Being LGBTQIA plus doesn't cause these problems, but it's something we go through that can affect mental health, such as discrimination, homophobia, transphobia, social isolation, rejection, and difficult experiences of coming out. And it's important to know that embracing one's identity can be a positive impact on well-being too, but can result in more confidence, sense of belonging in the community, and better relationships with friends and family, but also it does have a greater negative effect as well. And there's more, sorry. Cheerful stats here. Being LGBTQI doesn't mean someone will have more mental health issues, but it means they are higher risk of experiencing poor mental health. So what are all of your thoughts on that? Does that correlate with your own thinking, your own experiences of being in the community?
Do you want Alex to go?
I mean, Luciana, go for
okay.
it.
I think the community is in crisis. I think the numbers for mental health are ridiculously high. Suicide rates keep climbing. And with all the supposedly things that are there to help, it's not making any difference. Mm-hmm. I think we need to sort of clear everything and start over again. Mm-hmm. Because whatever is being done is not enough. And I think one of the reasons we started Across Rainbows was because if you look at the numbers, and those numbers are not even close. I mean, mm-hmm. They are a lot higher.
And they would have evolved
the
from...
suicide rates are so high. If any other community was going through this, the world would be up in arms. But it's okay because, I don't know. Mm. But, you know, all the... you know how I feel about D&I. Mm. But it's not working. I mean, how much education do straight people need? Mm-hmm. You know? Years and years of telling them and explaining. I think it's enough. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the help that's out there is not enough. It's mm-hmm. it's not good enough. Mm-hmm. And until I think as a community we sort of say we're done with this shit, sorry. You know, it's not going to get any better. We're just going to keep losing people.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a crisis.
Well, just to add to this as well, I've got some more stats and I will just read
these
out
for it.
And
we'll go back.
So gay and bi men are more likely to attempt suicide in their lifetime than the rest of the population. LGBTQIA people are 1.5 times more likely to develop depression, anxiety disorders, and compared to the rest of the population. And 67% of trans people had experienced depression in the previous year, and 46% had thought of ending their life. I mean, that's just astounding, really, isn't
because
it?
Because it's sad. You know what's really sad? It's not us, it's them that caused this. It's not about, and we're happy, we're fine, but they make life so difficult with hatred, and it's just, yeah, of course, anybody's going to end up, you know, having mental health crisis. But I think it's just time to say no more.
I mean, it's really interesting, and sorry, just to add, I think it's really interesting what you said, but I think if I think about my own mental health, and it'd be interesting to see all of your thoughts on this as well. You know, I remember being a teenager feeling, actually, I remember being anxious from a very, very young age. I have diagnosed OCD. I've been clinically diagnosed with it. It's something that I have to manage now through medication and through looking after my mental health. And when people hear about OCD, they think, oh, you like to tidy your wardrobe. No. It's like the worst things that can go through your head that you can imagine. And I think I was just always on high alert growing up, always on high alert and always doubting myself. And they call it the doubting disease. It's like you're always second guessing yourself. And I think the correlation with being queer and growing up and knowing that I was different, I was always on high alert, watching my back, wondering what was going to happen. You know, how could I live my life? What would that mean? All that kind of stuff. So I wonder whether, yes, absolutely, the communities outside of the queer community, the treatment that we receive isn't helping. But actually, do you think that when you grow up and that you know you're different, you're almost, especially, I guess, kids in the 80s, 90s, and hopefully it's getting better, but are you almost setting yourself up to have poor mental health because you're on high alert, because of, you know, what goes on in society, you know the kind of treatment you're going to have?
I mean, I was going to jump on what you were saying of like that with those numbers, because I was thinking it must be more than that, because it's almost like we just accept that it's part of our existence. And like, I mean, for me personally, like being a person of color as well, like I just, you know, my drag character is about being this like alien, and who does, you know, the reason I kind of go towards things like that is because I've never really felt like I fit in anywhere. And we were talking before we even started, I've lived in so many places, and each one of those places I've never felt like, you know, I'm like one of them. Do you know what I mean? I'm always the other one, or always most situations you go into, most you know, things you become a part of in life, whether it be school or work or whatever, you're always that other one. And so yeah, I think most of us have experienced just being on high alert since, well, childhood, or wherever you whenever you realized that you were different. But yeah, I would say most of us probably had that internal feeling of being different before we fully understood it anyway. So
what different meant?
Yeah, exactly. So
absolutely. What do you think, Mel?
So I just kept thinking about the time that when I kind of came out, it was the initial rejection and then the apology, like, oh, well, I'm just really worried that things will be really difficult for you. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that story a few times, many times, from other queer people. So then you're already taught that things are going to be difficult before you know what that looks like, because the people you're trusting that brought you into the world are telling you that they're terrified that something awful will happen to you. And I know that started well before I was born, but when people started coming out later and later through my life, we were still getting the same message. Like, I'm just really worried that you won't have an easy time. But like, what does that look like? And why weren't we taught that actually you can still be you and have just as good a chance of love and life and happiness as everyone else? But sometimes our initial response, and like my initial response didn't go well at all. But a lot of people that I know have had the, oh, well, we accept you. We're just worried that you'll just have a really tough time. Mm-hmm. And whatever age that is, how does that set us up for getting any of it right?
Confidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That will be okay. Yeah.
It's like when someone says something like that, I don't know about you, but I automatically feel like the pit of anxiety in my tummy.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, shit, what's going to happen?
Yeah,
what,
you're
what
like,
does that mean?
What are you, 15, 16, 25? Like, yeah. What does that feel like when someone that knows a bit more about life than you do that just says, I'm really worried that the next 10 years are like shit? Or like, you know, you'll have a really tough time.
You're doomed before you to open the door.
And I think, you know, people in parental figures, or people who are, their job is to nurture, I guess in some way, maybe they think they're protecting you. But it doesn't change the situation, doesn't it? You know, you're not just waking up one day going, oh, I've decided today I'm going to be gay or trans or whatever. So,
and I think those of us that are lucky enough that have had a parental figure to come out to, however well that went, if we've had that community still, we then normally end up with our own chosen family, and that's how we rebuild those connections. But it can really, that can stunt your growth emotionally and, you know, kind of psychologically before you're even ready to. That's what we talk about, like LGBT people having like a second adolescence, because whatever age we come out, we're having to readdress all those things that we didn't get to do when we were younger.
Yeah. Yeah. When you see all your friends kind of living their party life at 16, 17, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever, and you're kind of in the corner going, oh, yeah, I just like to be here to have fun. Really, you're bursting inside. Because
I'll hold your bag. Yeah.
I remember my friend saying to me, you never come out and pull. I'm like, yeah, I just really like to dance. And I was just like craving, like, you know, something, but I didn't even know what that was inside because I was too kind of scared. What about you, Michael? What do you think? Do you remember the original question?
Tell me again.
There's just the stats, you know, what does that, how does that reflect on your experiences?
I think for a long time, I thought I was alone in how I felt in terms of my mental health and everything correlated to it. And it was only when I started researching the book and through the book, starting to talk to my queer friends about their mental health that I was like, this isn't me. I'm not alone in this. I'm not broken. I'm not, you know, isolated in how I'm feeling. This isn't a me issue. This is society that is doing it to us. This is not, you know, any fault of a queer person. It's the structures in society that is making us feel this way, that is impacting our mental health and how we feel we belong in society, because it's set up in, you know, as we all know, a cis heteronormative way. And, you know, we're ostracized, we feel isolated, and so many of our journeys, we live alone in that, because, you know, so many of us find our chosen family later on in life, and we're living through, you know, understanding our sexuality and coming out in an isolated way. And it was only when I started doing the book that I was like, this is not just me. This is across the queer community. And it's, you know, as you said, the stats are horrifically high. And exactly going back to what you were talking about, Luciana, that, you know, our mental health support services are done through a cis heterosexual lens. So they are not tailored to our needs. They are not, you know, set up in a way that understands queer trauma or queer discrimination and how we can be supported and what our needs are. And, you know, looking at things like substance abuse and offsets of, you know, mental health, like the national guidelines of how much alcohol you should have per week is done through a cis lens. So it's done biologically. So how does that relate to trans people? You know, all of our health care in our healthcare systems are done through a cis heterosexual lens. So when we need support, it's not there and it's not done in the right way. So that is immediately a barrier for queer people accessing mental health support.
And the right support, I guess.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and I've not, you know, planned this question before, but chosen family, this comes up a lot and we talk about this a lot, right? But what strikes me is you can meet people that, you know, you have that kinship with, you connect with, and that's wonderful. But I think we're all going through something. So how effective have you all found chosen family? And have there been times where you thought you found your chosen family, the people that you think really get you, and then you realize that actually together, this isn't going to work because we've all got the stuff kind of going on? Because I think that can be a real risky thing for everyone, can't it? If you're feeling vulnerable or poorly, and then you know that someone else is, and you're trying to make that connection, that could probably end up in chaos. So what does chosen family mean to all of you, and how easy has it been to find those people?
I think chosen family has been life-saving for me. I don't think if I had the friends I did when I was a lot younger, I probably wouldn't be here. Like, in all honesty, I probably wouldn't be here. And they were essential to me because I only came out to my immediate family within the last 3 years. So, I mean, it's not late comparatively. There's people who come out a lot later than I did, but they were essential for me in terms of my development, my mental health, my support systems. So I, for me, it was entirely essential for my well-being and who I am today. And I think in terms of, you know, what you're talking about in terms of everyone's going through their things, I think there's a collective understanding and a shared experience of what we're going through, even if it's not always shared. And, you know, everyone has their own different experiences and things that they're working through. But I feel like within a chosen family, there's an understanding there of what we're processing and what we've gone through, whether that's bullying or rejection from family or, you know, discrimination. I feel like even if it's not openly talked about, there's an understanding. And, you know, like you said, like it could just be going dancing and that can be huge for our mental health.
It's a release.
You know, yeah, it's a release. And, you know, you're there with your friends and you're laughing and you're having the best time, which, you know, growing up as kids, we could never imagine that. Like you're saying, being at a house party and being like, this isn't my place. There's no queer people here. There's not someone I can make out with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can live that together with our chosen family. And even just, you know, having those times together is a hugely beneficial thing.
Makes a difference.
To our mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. Luciana, what about you? And I hope you, obviously we've talked separately, we've had coffee and we've had conversations. Obviously you came out later in life and you have a family, and what about your experiences and kind of like finding your identity and, you know, living your truth? What was there an impact for your mental health in terms of that journey, or was it something that you were able to kind of process quite easily?
Mm-hmm. I didn't even know it was I had mental health issues.
Okay.
Because I grew up nuns like yeah, and they mental health is not a thing. You just got on with it. I think I realized that I found out about mental health, funnily enough, was watching Oprah. She was talking about something, and I thought, well, actually, is that me? But, yeah, I felt very lonely. I always felt different, but just very, very lonely. And I just, you know, almost like a robotic way of life. But, you know, when you have children, they became my reason for living, because I think without them, I wouldn't have bothered. But it's, I think I'm very resilient, so I'm also quite logical, but I thought, just because then I ended up spending 2 years in therapy, which really saved my life, and it made me feel like, you know, I was actually really normal. Mm-hmm. Everything I felt, everything I went through, and yeah, I sort of think that woman saved my life. Yeah.
Therapy, so, I think, I mean, even if you're having, you know, an okay time, or you're having the crisis, therapy, talking, is so underrated, but it really does help. It's like being able to express yourself freely without judgment to someone and feel listened to. I think it is a lifesaver.
But I think the biggest problem, and I speak to people and I see the same sort of reflected back at me, is, and maybe people don't believe this, but I really do believe that, you know, society is controlled through shame. They sort of shame you into thinking, so people are afraid to do anything or say anything. And I think I just from hearing things and stuff, I really, really struggled with, you know, this like secret, you know, that couldn't tell anyone. And of course, shame thrives if it's in a dark place and you don't talk about it.
Yeah.
So once I found a voice, it was like, Really? You know, because it's what people tell you. It's not what you've actually experienced. But like Melanie said, then, you know, it's almost a self-prophesizing. Well, you're going to have this happen to you. So, yeah. And I think it's the shame that sort of almost like paralyzes us, you know?
Well, we talked about shame last week. And one of the things we mentioned was shame can't survive with empathy. And I think that when you live your truth and you discover who you are and you get the support you need and you become your own ally, the advocate for yourself, I think that, you know, hopefully that shame then reduces because you are treating yourself with the respect that you deserve. I mean, obviously Across Rainbows, an amazing mission to redefine queer identity. Can you tell everyone about that mission and kind of your hopes for that, I guess, and what inspired it in the first place?
So what inspired it was my son, Nick. He was 12 and really struggling with questioning. And you know, I really wanted him to have an amazing coming out. Like, literally, I wanted the sparkles and the parade and, you know, it didn't happen. But, you know, this was like work in progress. But he was severely bullied. And I looked for help for him, and there was nothing. And when he was, do you mind if I say this? No. Yeah. So when he was around 14, he was, you know, you could have five little boys. One is usually gay, right? And the other four know before the gay one knows. So they start the bullying. Anyway, so he was bullied quite severely, and there was no help. And so I was a business consultant, and so we did workshops and stuff. So I thought, okay, maybe approach this logically. And instead of trying to fix what's around him, is to give him the tools to be able to stand up and defend himself. And that's how Across Rainbows started. And we sort of used to work with, because this is the sad part, is that a lot of kids end up leaving school early. They sort of don't get jobs. They, you know, and really talented, brilliant kids. But they don't feel good enough. They don't feel, they always feel less than. So we started these really intensive workshops. And I'm happy to say they were very successful. They've gone on to become artists. And so we've taken it now to the next level where we're sort of, we believe, I'm just going to say this really quickly, that one of the reasons for mental health, and this is a belief, is that as when you're coming out, you almost like outsource your identity to what society wants you to be. So you really don't know who you are. And if you don't know who you are, you're going to have mental health issues. That we sort of created this thing called repetitive paralysis, where you're always changing jobs, changing partners, changing homes, changing because you don't know who you are, so you're always looking for that answer. Mine was changing homes. I think I moved 30 times. I was always changing jobs. But once you know who you are, then you can stand in that power, and nobody can move you. So
that's amazing. I think that deserves a round of applause, really. That is incredible, and what a support to Nick. That's incredible. Thank you for sharing.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Alex, we obviously talked earlier today, and one thing I wanted to talk about was, I guess, the intersectionalities within our community, because this is something that I think has been spoken about more and more over recent years, yeah, with good reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have friends who are of colour and have had mental health issues over the years because of prejudice they've felt or how society has treated them for just who they are. So I guess when we then intersect that with queerness, drag,
yeah,
what a, you know, that opens up another discussion. Yeah. So
I mean, I've kind of got to a point in my life where I just accept every freak flag I have as just one flag. I'm just like, it's too complicated to like detangle it, and you know, because it is all interlocked, like, you know. I grew up in like the early 2000s, like that's when I was going to school, and we moved around a lot, and you know, especially some of the areas we lived where there wasn't. So when I moved to Sussex, like, you know, I love Brighton, but when I moved here, it was a culture shock. Like, I had lived in like place, usually cities where there was, you know, I was still the minority, but you know, there was a couple of people I could like do the little obligatory black person nod, you know, or whatever. But yeah, like me and my sister, until now we're adults, we went undiagnosed as autistic for, you know, most of our lives. So, and I know a lot of people of color who have things like autism or ADHD or whatever. It goes under the radar, and especially if you're queer as well, because I think people just say, "Oh, well, you know, Alex is just like that because, you know, she a queen or whatever." Like, you know, she, and as I said, it's in my adult years, it's become too difficult to try and detangle, the mental health, acrobatics I've had to do to accept my race, to accept my queerness. When it comes to my race, like I'm mixed race. I'm half white. So that has been something I've had to come to terms with, and it has affected my mental health greatly. I don't have any contact with my dad's side of the family, who is the white side of my family, because they are extremely upper middle class, very religious, racist. Like, yeah, they were growing up with them was very, very difficult, and I have taken a lot of the things they used to say to me and my sister growing up into life, and I'm working through it. I just want to make sure I'm hitting the question. No. I just feel like I'm just giving my autobiography right now.
I guess it's just about how important it is to recognize and keep the platform going for, yeah, conversations about intersectionality, because, you know, we've all talked about coming out, the difficulties of that. But I think when you look at it from a point of view where, you know, we are living in a world that is built for white, middle class, yeah, et cetera. So to be a person of color and then to come out as queer as well, you're not just a minority, you're then a minority.
Yeah.
And I think we are talking about this more and more, but I don't think we've, over recent years until now, have really realized the impact of that. And I guess it's I think it's really important to talk about it. So I just really keen to understand your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, if you had probably asked me this question a couple of years ago, I probably would have had a much more, not volatile kind of answer, but I when we were talking before about Chosen Family, luckily now, the last couple of years me doing drag, I have a very close-knit Chosen Family of like drag performers, and we're probably the most diverse drag house in Brighton, I would say. House of Debauchery, Billy Gold is part of the house. So I have a lot of people that I can turn to, not only my mum, because I think my mum was my main support system. It similar to you two's relationship, my mum was like my biggest champion. So being an adult now and not living at home, and also just I don't want to be bothering her with everything all the time, like she must get sick of me. I think you're right, it is something that we need to talk about more. I was going somewhere with that. Let's pretend I found it and we'll move on.
I think you know, we have, I mean, obviously we have UK Black Pride.
Yeah.
We have, you know, Pride generally. But I think one thing that we've, a common thing we've talked about on all of the episodes is a hierarchy within the community,
yeah,
which shouldn't exist. But I think it's something we have to keep talking about and bring an awareness to, because whether it's because of colour or transness, or yeah, whether you're bi or gay or mask or whatever it might be, it's, there seems to be some sort of hierarchy.
Yeah.
And I think we have to keep shining a light on it to abolish it, basically,
yeah,
because it's bullshit, isn't
it? Well, because I think when I came out, I kind of like, and especially when I found like queer communities and queer friends, like I really thought like, okay, I found my people. And then it's like, oh, well, you know, there's still white people that want to say like some crazy shit to me. So, oh wait, you said we could swear, right?
You can, yeah.
Oh, thank fuck, Jesus Christ. But yeah, like I felt like once I entered some queer communities, like I still had the barrier of like racism to like deal with. And, you know, it was just kind of like this feeling of like, oh shit, not again. Like, do you know what I mean? Like another barrier I have to like break down.
How do we keep that conversation going then? How do we, and again, and sorry to ask this.
Yeah.
And because actually I don't want to ask it because, you know, we look at the history of Black Lives Matter and education. Yeah. It shouldn't be for you to tell us why it's important to keep that conversation going. So I'm not asking it on that basis, but I am asking from the basis of how important it is for us to keep that, because you would have experienced that, I guess, and it shouldn't be, it's not something we should have to think about, but we do. So how do we keep that conversation going so that it stops, essentially?
Yeah.
So people do walk into the community and don't feel they're having to think about all the different, yeah, facets of their personality.
Well, I just like, I always tell people whenever, especially when Black Lives Matter during 2020 was like at its height and everything, I always used to tell people, it's just as simple as like, ask yourself, like, are you judging this person based on something that they've done or something they are? Mm. Like, and I think it literally just comes to as simple as that, because you know, and we blow things up to, you know, into all these complicated debates and which are valid and need to happen as well. But I think the simple question people just need to ask themselves is just like, am I judging this person based on something they've done or something that I see in front of me? Because that's as simple as it, you know, like people have so many assumptions about me before I even open my mouth when I enter a room, and, you know, and I can see it when I engage them in conversation, and, or, you know, they might even say like, oh, don't you speak well or something like that. And it's like, fucking hell, I was born in Croydon. Like, shit, it's not that exotic. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so, yeah, so I think it is important to keep those conversations going, but I do think it is just a simple question people need to ask themselves of just like, how am I judging people?
Yeah, and yeah, I guess be kind, be decent,
yeah,
treat everyone respectfully,
yeah,
regardless of anything. And I think that's something we can all take away from this as well. It's regardless of any facet of your personality, just be kind to people.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. Absolutely. Thank, yeah, you for sharing that.
No problem at all. No problem at all.
Michael, you have written an amazing book, which I absolutely loved last year, now available on audiobook as well, just to plug that. It's called Differences Born on the Lips, and it's part memoir, part exposé, looking at the societal prejudice and, I guess, conditions of abusive relationships, mental health crises and things for queer people. So can you talk to us about your book, which I know you're going to do a little reading from in a bit before we do the interval, but how cathartic was it for you to write this personally? And I guess how has that evolved your journey as a queer person, especially around your mental health as well?
I think it was huge. I think until, you know, I've said this before, like if the pandemic hadn't happened, I wouldn't have written this book and I wouldn't have reckoned with a lot of the issues that I've personally gone through and, you know, sat down to understand them. I think, you know, the lockdowns gave me that time to sit and understand everything that I'd gone through. What's the question again?
How many beers have you had today?
4.
We haven't even started the shots yet.
I know. No, I can't wait for the interval.
There's no shame.
It's going to get...
No, I guess it's just how cathartic was it for you to write that? And also for your own journey of discovery and acceptance of your mental health and yourself.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, the biggest part of my journey of my mental health. As I was saying earlier, I'd never really stopped to kind of understand why, really throughout my entire life, that I'd been struggling with my mental health, whether that was anxiety or depression or being suicidal, and never really stopped to process it and understand why I was feeling that way and why it had happened, and also, you know, how what I'd been struggling with in my mental health was impacting in other parts of my area. So we were, Melanie and I were talking outside about domestic abuse in the queer community. And I'd never understood that my mental health was impacting my relationships with other people and what I accepted as normal and as a standard in my relationships with other men. And I didn't realize until that point that my mental health was integral to that, that my self-esteem, my self-respect, my, you know, you know, how I viewed myself and my mental health was what I was willing to accept from other people. And until I sat down and wrote this book, I didn't realize that. I didn't correlate the two, that, you know, I'd been through two abusive relationships and didn't realize that because of what I'd gone through in my life and how I viewed myself and, you know, my own mental health and believing that that was the love I deserved, until I, you know, had this time to sit down and reflect on my mental health and my journey, you know, I never would have made those correlations. And, you know, that's the one of the biggest things that we need to start discussing, is not just how mental health impacts us as an individual, but how it impacts our relationships with other people, not necessarily a romantic relationship, but with our family, with our friends, with our colleagues. You know, as queer people, we, you know, we're getting by, and we, you know, I don't think we take the time to stop and think about, you know, our mental health in a wider context and what we accept from other people. And I think it was last week someone was talking about, you know, when you start putting up those boundaries and those walls to protect yourself, that people say you're selfish. And, you know, that really resonated with me with last week, of when you start to protect your mental health and when you start to protect yourself, that's when your relationships change. And I think that's really vital for us to start recognizing, is that we do need to start protecting ourselves and look at, you know, the love and the relationships and the friendships that we accept, because, you know, that's what we think we deserve. And, you know, there's a little bit of validation there. There's a little bit of giving. And that's what we accept, because that's what we're craving, because for so much of our lives, we've been rejected for our identities, for our gender, for our sexuality, for, you know, all of the other intersectionalities, that from childhood, they've been rejected. So we will accept that small bit of love or attention, even if it's not healthy for us.
I guess it's validating in some way until it's not, and then it becomes difficult. It's really interesting what you said about the boundaries, and because I think if you put boundaries up or you do start protecting yourself, if people truly understand, they'll stick around and they'll support you. If people don't, and that's a threat, you'll see those relationships start to, I think that's quite common. Thank you for sharing that. Mel, obviously you're a domestic abuse worker and the outreach lead for Across Rainbows, which is incredible. And I know that confidentiality with this stuff is paramount. So I'm not going to ask you to go into cases and that kind of stuff. But I think what I'd like you to do, if you could, is just share the type of things or experiences that you've had within your role. Because I think sometimes we don't necessarily think about things happening within the community, or any community. You know, if it doesn't affect you, you don't necessarily think about it. But obviously, abuse and, you know, struggles are prevalent within the queer community. So are you happy to share some of your experiences and actually how your role helps and supports others?
Yeah, so there's a few, but there's one that springs to mind that just happened recently. I was trying to chase up a homelessness application that I'd made a week previous, and I was staying with this client and calling the council on his behalf, and the council, just the person on the other side, had decided she'd made her decision on that he wasn't priority need. We had a bit of an argument. She overshot me, shouted at me, and then hung up at me. And as I was sitting with him, this person hasn't eaten for several days. Every time I've seen him recently, I've given him my lunch because he's not had anything to eat for days. Like, and you can see the blood come back into his face just having something to eat. So his mental health is obviously crashing because his physical health isn't great. And then they then, because they decided that they had denied his application, I couldn't do anything other than try and get him on street support. It didn't go well this week. It hasn't gone well at all for either of us. And he's ended up in a really bad way. And I took that on really badly on Friday when I found out, because I felt like, kind of through that circumstance, I was in some way responsible. I know it's not me, and I will raise hell tomorrow. But that, like, pressure that we take on, because especially being part of the LGBT community and wanting to help our, like, our people in this community when they're very, their existence is sometimes denied, even in Brighton and Hove, where we're supposed to be the acknowledged, like, the gayest city in the country. I'm having fights with some bitch in the council who doesn't want to acknowledge that, you know, we might just be just as vulnerable as some other cis, white female who's fleeing domestic abuse. And I know that that's just as valid, but our validity, like, is sometimes so overlooked. And this isn't the first time it's happened, and it's happened. I have a client that I've been working with for a long time, and her validity has been overlooked. Like, her relationship has been talked about, like, a relationship breakdown, and, you know, they've used other little words to dance around the fact that it's been domestic abuse. Like, that's the point I'm always trying to push. Like, we're just as valid as everybody else, and we're just as likely to mess up and have, you know, mess and domestic abuse in our relationships and issues that we might come across as any other person in the world. Like, just because we're queer and we have this, like, a small community we want to protect, we're just as vulnerable as any other person in the world. And so when we're having these conversations with authorities and people in authority, I swear, I wish one of them would just, like, sometimes listen when we say that we're a part of the community and we know what we're talking about and we are qualified and we are LGBT. And I'm telling you that this person is, you know, is just as vulnerable as whoever you've just put in a refuge. You know, like, we don't have access to that same kind of support. We just don't. It doesn't exist. So when I'm trying to get support from the councils or, you know, the police, you know, sometimes the police have turned up 3 or 4 deep in uniform to someone that I've had make a safeguarding report on. And it's been a historic report, and that's what we have to do, because that's our safeguarding, you know, our promise. When I've called and just said, like, please, please, they're terrified of the police. We don't have a great relationship with the police. Let's all understand that for a very good reason. Please, just, is there somewhere we can have a delicate conversation about this, or we can come to you with a non-uniform officer? Twice it's happened to me. With 3 or 4 uniformed officers have turned up at someone's property because I've had to make a safeguarding report. Like, where on earth does that level of safety and community and responsibility come in when you're going to frighten people? And where is our trust going to come from? And then you add on trauma and like levels of like being outed and coming out to police. You know, you're coming out to any level of authority and then not understanding the terminology or even just accepting who you're telling them you are. If you're just assumed to be heteronormative, coming out when you're traumatized is really difficult, especially if you've had a traumatic experience coming out. Then you add on the fact that you're having to tell them that you're fleeing your boyfriend or girlfriend or partner. It's just, there's levels of like a lack of understanding that I sometimes baffles me.
Like, just to add on to that, like,
sorry,
for my own.
No.
I was just like, suddenly clapping there for it. But, like, from my own experience, when I was being stalked by my previous partner, like, went to the National Stalking Helpline, and they were like, well, the only way that this is going to get resolved if you go to court. And I was like, okay, I'm not out to my family. Recovering from this abusive relationship, I'm now being stalked. You know, we're exactly what you're saying. Like, there's so many traumas, there's so many layers that we need protecting and understanding from. For someone to go through those processes is horrific for some people.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't do anything. I didn't proceed. I just let it continue because I was like, I emotionally cannot go through a court case.
Yeah.
After coming out of an abusive relationship and my family not knowing that I'm gay, you know, there's exactly what you're saying. Like, someone could be outed. You know, the level of support and understanding is just not there in our judicial system, in our police system, in our mental health system. Like, there's all of these layers.
But we're talking safeguarding, right? With so many, like, heteronormative assumptions. We don't talk safeguarding in the LGBT community. So like being outed, like losing your home, like losing your family. That's a safeguarding level that I think is something that we should all kind of understand when we're talking protecting someone's safety. And that's what we do when we take vulnerable adults and children, because we have a safeguarding policy. And we don't have that for LGBT people, because that's why you end up vulnerable.
Do you think that, and obviously thank you for sharing, you know, what you have. Do you think that there is enough awareness out there about domestic abuse and mental health within our community? Everyone's shaking their heads. No.
I mean, they don't, police don't really even take it seriously if two men are having a domestic dispute. I mean, I've worked at the probation. They love that officer. You know, they can defend themselves.
Is that because they're two men?
Men. They don't take it seriously.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Call it like mutual combat or some other bullshit. Like, you know, it's two men having a fight or whatever. Yeah. It's dismissed because it couldn't possibly be a male perpetrator and a male victim, or, you know, or, you know.
Is it the same for two women as well?
Yeah.
I've actually had cases where they've dismissed it.
Because
they've just called it a relationship breakdown. And another one where they've said that two neighbors have fallen out because they happen to live near each other.
Yeah.
And I had said over and over again, it's domestic abuse. It's being considered that, like, this person isn't being housed because she's fleeing domestic abuse, and they wouldn't acknowledge it anytime.
And again, I'm assuming, this is an assumption, but I'm assuming if that's the case for two men and two women, gender non-conforming or trans people,
don't get me started.
Down the line, isn't it? It's not going
to
happen.
We don't exist in most spaces, according to some people. Do you know what I mean?
So, yeah.
I read an article and I literally cried about how trans people, when they die, they go back to their original. I think that's horrible. I don't know if it happens in England. This is in America, but it's really horrible. They just.
Well, I think if you haven't had the gender
certificate,
it doesn't.
It can happen.
Yeah, but a lot of them don't, right?
No, because it's expensive. It's costly to get a GRC, right?
But they've lived all their life, and then they die, and they just check that box. Yeah. I think it's so horrible.
So, yeah.
Sorry.
No. Speak. It's important. I think it's important we talk about this. So, okay, two questions then. What do we need to do in our community to improve mental health for ourselves and for each other? And what do we need? I mean, pretty much there's a lot we need externally, but actually, what do we need? What action do we need to call upon the people at the top, the people that are running the country, the people that have influence and power to support our community? Because it just feels like it isn't there.
Well, we need to vote them out first. Yeah, like, yeah, that's the top solution. Need to get them motherfuckers out of there.
Out, yeah.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's go internally first. So, Luciana, what do we need to do? Because we've talked about this several times over coffee, getting our own house in order, especially around allyship. You know, I think we've talked about we can have great allies, but actually it feels like we're missing a trick internally first.
I think we need to be loud, really loud. Really, 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 really loud, and say, not taking this anymore. Just, I mean, it's, you know, they count on us playing small. You know, they think, like, you know, Melanie's saying, this poor people, you know, all this trouble. You really think they're going to go to court after all this? But, you know, but it shouldn't be allowed to get to that stage. And I think it's the fundamentals that need to change. I think we need to, like I said, we need to start over again and just, you know, be the people we need to be for ourselves. No one else is going to show up. We need to show up for ourselves.
And for each other.
And for each other,
so important.
We're going to save ourselves in the end.
Yeah.
No one else is going to do it.
Mm-hmm. What about externally? Alex, what do you think about external?
Well, I just wanted to jump on
what
was just said, because like I totally agree with this, because personally myself, like I have such a fear of like establishment in general, like to the point where I will put off like making a doctor's appointment because of just like how many times I've been judged for being black or queer or whatever. And, you know, I even going to Specsavers, yeah, like I'm just like, oh God, no, like anything filling out forms or anything, you know, it's just, it's stressful. But yeah, it's taking that responsibility for yourself and going, no, I need, because I'm one more voice to be added to the mass to make change and in whatever situation.
And,
but yeah, oh, no, sorry. Go on.
No, sorry.
Oh, okay. And then what were you, externally, what do we need?
Yeah, I guess externally,
yeah.
You know, what do we need to see? How do we stop what Mel's described? How do, and that's a
well,
question, but
I don't really know what is the road to this, but like, as far as I'm concerned, until we have more queer people, more people of color, more people with disabilities in positions where change can actually be enacted. Because, of course, we can do everything we can to be loud and to get out there and do what needs to be done. But when you're talking to someone who on the other end of the phone or in person or whatever during your, I can imagine like most of the time it isn't a queer person and it isn't, you know, someone who understands what you're describing. And sometimes, you know, as much as you can try your hardest to get people to understand, sometimes you just can't get past that wall. I've seen it in conversations I've had with people where I've just gone, you know what, you don't even you're not even close to understanding this perspective because you are unwilling to leave, you know, the box, you know, which none of us live inside. I've never even seen a box. I don't know what a box looks like. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know what the road to that is. I know that first, you know, we need to vote the people in power out.
Like, also,
get them out.
Yeah, but yeah.
I think we need to start losing those words, tolerance and acceptance, enough.
Yeah.
You know, those two words need to come out of the vocabulary.
I don't ever want to be tolerated.
Exactly.
Yeah. Get
no.
fucked.
Yes. Fuck
just,
that.
No. Just the, right there. Secondly, I think the people who do sit at the table, they're not the right people.
No.
They sell out. They, you know, they just, oh, we don't have a voice, but we're sitting at the table. No, you know, they need to be head of the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you know, it's funny, you know, and again, I don't know if this is a bit controversial, but when election comes up and they say, who are you voting for? I haven't got a clue because I don't trust anyone. It's like, maybe we need to start our own party. How can we, you know?
I know who I don't trust though. So
sorry?
That's a good place to start. I know who I don't trust.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I don't know, but I don't.
You start doing like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's how you end up voting.
But
yeah.
There's so much misinformation and so much that's promised and doesn't deliver that you just kind of think, well, how, you know, how do we make that change? It's just so tricky. Thank you all so much for your contributions. Don't turn your mic off yet because you've got to read something. So I'm really pleased that you're going to be doing this because, as I said, I read this book last year and I think it's incredible and I'm so happy we're getting to speak tonight. But Michael has written an incredible book which is on sale today at the bookstand.
Please buy the book.
My lovely husband is selling. But yeah, would you like to read something from your, sure, your wonderful book? And you can take my copy and sign it later if you like.
I will sign it for you. There was...
Don't judge me for folding back pages. Sorry, I do that.
I'm just seeing them all.
Did you pick the page?
Sorry?
Did you pick the page?
No. I always fold back the pages. I know that people like really frown upon that, but it's just like my thing.
How long do I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay.
Well, I'm not timing you, but you know.
Sorry, I'm just trying to find the bit. There was a bit I liked. Okay, got it. So this is from chapter 12, which it's a bit of a love letter to the friends, the chosen family in my family who got me through a lot of the stuff that I got through. Trauma is not stored as a narrative with an orderly beginning, middle, and end. This played a fundamental role in my healing. It helped me understand that the abuse I experienced wasn't an isolated product. My mental health problems weren't an isolated product. They weren't neatly tied up in a beginning, middle, end. Trauma will surface at many points in life, not just at the trauma's conception, and can influence you in a multitude of ways. Just because it may not have an obvious impact at the time doesn't mean it hasn't affected you inside, hasn't altered how you react to the world, to yourself, others around you. The body records everything. It changes, even if nothing looks like it has changed. Nothing is destroyed, even if it may be forgotten. Trauma doesn't just appear and disappear. We get up every day shouldering a weight, even if we can't feel it. The everyday microaggressions, the long-standing abuse and othering from childhood, the shame, the guilt. It shifts and influences, blooms and explodes in ways we can't predict. It hovers over us, waking up and not knowing why we feel down, what's wrong, why we don't feel like carrying on, why we're so tired. Humans are resilient. We can function for years, decades, until the body or mind finally signal that it can't handle it anymore. Our mental health can only take so much. Healing is not a switch. It's one step at a time, sometimes steps backwards or sideways. I've tried antidepressants, been through therapy, written to understand, read, throwing myself into different activities that would help me feel better in myself. There is not a magic trick to overcome what we've gone through and been through. No potion to drink that will erase the past and transform us into an entirely different person. We don't live in fairy tales. My journey out of abuse, my path to begin to deal with my mental health issues, will not be the same for everyone. The biggest part was to live my life, live who I am and who I want to be, embracing and loving my truth, not what others, not what society expects of me. See myself in all its entirety, its beauty, its importance. If there is one thing to remember, it is you are beautiful and you are valued. We cannot let the world minimize us. That journey still continues. There is no failure. It's a series of falling on and off the bandwagon. It's a process that will continue, but there is a route for everyone. That is why we must continue to talk, to heal together, to speak up, to challenge. The world is full of systemic barriers and structures that are in place to bring us down, to make us feel different, to weaken us. We cannot change the world if the world doesn't understand the realities that we face, how our lives are affected by what has been set up around us. We cannot change the world by doing it by ourselves or taking each other down. We have to dissect what is going on around us in order to understand what it is we need to do to make that future better. We have to understand the past, how it affects our present, and how we can shape the present into a different future. They don't work in isolation. We all have many beginnings and many endings. It's at what point we start to define ourselves. Finding that point is key to beginning to address and work through the trauma. Continuing to find those new beginnings, finding those ending points to move on and start a new chapter in our healing. We take our history with us. We cannot destroy the past. We cannot change it. We can evolve from it, though. We can learn from it, accept it, and move forward as a different person. Ad Lucem, Towards the Light, was embroidered on the red badge I wore on my blazer at school years ago. Another day, another dawn, one more step towards the light.
Thank you very much. Big round of applause. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. And that book is on sale right now in the interval. So big thank you to everyone. We're going to take a small break. We'll come back in about 20 minutes for an audience Q&A. So if anyone has any questions, please get them ready. And we'll look at it, Darren. Please get them ready. And we will, we'll do some audience Q&A. But thank you so much. And thank you to my guests.
The conversation doesn't stop here. Check out the next part of this podcast episode on your streaming platform. You will not be disappointed. I really hope you enjoyed the show. A big thank you once again to all my guests. Please share the podcast, give it a 5-star review if you'd like, and leave any comments you may have. You can also follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok for all the latest updates on Queer I Am, the podcast. Also, check out my website, www.fluiactually.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.